Tell me what you've chosen to read for us today.
I have chosen to read the opening of the opening story of my new book, Mr. Tall. And the story is called Haunted Castles of the Barrier Islands.
Would you give me an idea of where we're going with this story and then begin?
It's about a middle-aged couple, Daryl and Cheryl, who go to see their daughter at college, surprise her, and hopefully hilarity ensues. Haunted Castles of the Barrier Islands. In October, Daryl and Cheryl drove from Argyle, North Carolina, all the way to Wilmington, nearly 8 hours, to surprise their daughter, Misty, who was a freshman at UNCW, on her 19th birthday. They found her locked in her dorm room, dressed but flushed and disheveled, with a scrawny wannabe surfer named Kyle. Kyle wore temporarily indecent board shorts and a t-shirt with F**K**U printed across the front. His hair looked casually windblown, an illusion spoiled by the mousse holding it in place. By the time he took hold of Daryl's thumb and said, "Sup, dude," Daryl hated him thoroughly. He wanted to yank Kyle's horny, pimpled little heart out of his chest and shake it at him before cramming him down his throat. Instead, he said, "Nice asterisk, slick." Daryl had randomly selected slick from a list of diminutions that included buddy, chief, and sport. Kyle blinked and let go of Daryl's thumb. He either didn't know what an asterisk was or couldn't believe that Misty's dad had just called him slick. Misty looked panic-stricken and tried to catch Kyle's eye. Cheryl touched Daryl's arm and said, "Daryl?" Somewhere on the hall, a door slammed. Kyle said, "Yo, Mist, I'll check you later," and didn't look again at any of them. Daryl said, "What's your hurry, Chief?" Then they took Misty out to supper. Along a four-lane strip of car dealerships, big box stores, and Mexican groceries, Misty picked a seafood place ringed by a moat of empty parking spaces. Its only virtue seemed to be that it was a long way from campus. "Sweetie, I was hoping that maybe we could go someplace nice, on the water," Cheryl said. She idealized the ocean the way mountain people often do. She said she never got tired of looking at it, but had never looked at it enough to know if that statement was actually true. "You can't get into those places on Friday nights unless you have a reservation," Misty said, "and I gather you didn't make a reservation." Her phone beeped, and she tapped out a long text message while Daryl and Cheryl gnawed on breadsticks and watched. She snapped the phone shut and propped it carefully against the napkin dispenser, where she glanced at it every few seconds. "Who was that?" Cheryl asked, pleasantly enough, trying to make conversation. "Oh, that was just my friend," Misty said, almost biting off the F. "You know, slick." Daryl excused himself and went to the restroom, where he confronted and killed a truculent Tidewater cockroach. He thought about leaving the carcass on the floor for the next diner to see, but calling Kyle both slick and chief had depleted his reservoir of vindictiveness. So he picked it up with a wad of toilet paper and commended it to the deep.
I hear a recurring theme, the wish for death of a young man in some sort of rivalry of love, here father-daughter.
Well, my daughters are 10 and 7. I can already work myself up into a lather, imagining their high school years, and then I can make myself weep imagining them going away to college. Which is what I did while I was writing this story. I sat and cried like an idiot.
No fooling.
And my daughter was, I think, 8 at the time I wrote it. 7, maybe. And I was imagining 11 years into the future.
I'm sorry I'm laughing at you. It's not fair. In reading your work, it seems to me that I think you spent 3 years as a journalist in small town North Carolina.
Right.
It seems like you listened a lot.
Well, I'm still drawing on material that I got from being a reporter in my hometown. And actually, Daryl and Cheryl own a small newspaper in this story that looks suspiciously like the small newspaper I worked in North Carolina. But I was a feature writer, and my job was to find people who had interesting stories and tell those stories. I've always been a listener. I mean, I used to drop in restaurants and I hear somebody say something interesting. And my wife gets a little irritated when I shush her so I can listen to the diners at the next table.
Mm-hmm. I was especially amused by the array of people in The Prophet from Jupiter.
There were a lot of stories there from my time as a newspaper reporter.
I want to ask you about the structure of that story, because I noticed something happening, and I didn't know if it's unique to you, but it seemed to me in that story that you were sentence by sentence by sentence carrying the thread of the stories in that story, you know, all the individual stories. You seem to build it like that. Am I overreacting or what?
That story does have a very odd form, and I think the form was suggested by the dilemma of the protagonist himself. He has a story to tell himself about himself that is so painful, he really can't tell it. And so he talks about everything else that he knows and then just intersperses his story in little snatches all the way through in just the sentence or two that he can bear to say.
And his story, too, is about failure and love. In reading your short stories in Here We Are in Paradise, so many of the protagonists were not having any success in relationship. In Gettysburg, I thought that was particularly poignant with this basketball star who was really adult.
Well, I wrote that book when I was in graduate school, and pretty much all my attempts at love were failing. You know, as a theme, I think that love fails all the time. And the way one responds is, you know, you get up the next morning and you try to love better that day. Some days marriage is absolutely terrific, and some days it's hard. And, you know, I just make sure that I get up the next morning and try it again.
In the process of writing, I'd like to move to the novel, The Blue Star. The protagonist, Jim, wanting to kill Bucky, basically, throughout the book. Bucky, the rival for his girl. And there's a passage that Uncle Zeno says to Jim that he's a better man than wishing for Bucky's death. And Jim says, no, I'm not. And then Uncle Zeno says, you have to choose to be a good man. You have to choose every minute of every day. As soon as you don't, you're lost. I wonder if that's the pivot. And if it is the pivot, how do you forecast a pivot to a book like The Blue Star?
Well, I'm not understanding what you mean by forecast.
If you're structuring a novel, in your imaginative life, how do you organize your thoughts about getting to a point like that in the book that seems to be the kernel of it, you know, the nut of it, and building a story around it with the setting, all of the mountain scenes? What is the process you take in imaginatively forecasting that structure to a book?
Well, the only thing I really forecast is the beginning and the end. And the end always changes. And so that moment that turns out to be pivotal, where Uncle Zeno tells Jim that, that was something I discovered along the way. That wasn't something I had when I started. I know that a book's going well when the characters begin speaking among themselves, and it feels more like taking dictation than planning. And often when it's going well and I plan what I want them to say, they refuse to say it. I know that sounds completely odd, but when it's going well, that's what it feels like.
That must be pretty wonderful. I thought the trip taking Chrissy home up the mountain had more to it than met the eye, but I can't verbalize that. That whole scene in the abandoned house. Can you talk about that scene and how it came to you?
I knew the road and I knew the house, just sort of both imaginatively and from North Carolina. And once they began exploring the house, again, that was a moment where they sort of took off on their own. And when Chrissy began to pretend to be somebody else in order that she could speak romantically to Jim, I remember I was so excited because it felt like I hadn't thought of that. And I sort of couldn't wait to see what happened next. Again, when I'm having a good day, I sort of get lost inside the story. And that moment feels to me like Chrissy's story, Chrissy's idea rather than mine. But believe me, nobody was more tickled by that moment than I was.
I'd also like you to speak to the dream sequence when Jim is riding in the cold in the back of the pickup with Bucky's coffin.
The funny thing about the dream sequences in my work is that when I teach creative writing, I always tell my students to not use dream sequences. That they're the only formal convention you can use that is always symbolic and identifies itself as symbolic. But I say that, and then I think all of my books have dream sequences. So I guess that makes me either a hypocrite or not very bright when I teach. You know, I needed Bucky to appear and confront Jim. Just, I thought, dramatically, you know, that had to happen. But obviously, since Bucky is stationed in the Pacific and Jim is in North Carolina, there's no way for that to happen. And I came up with the idea of Bucky's ghost. I'm also maybe a little embarrassed to admit it. I'm very interested in the paranormal and the supernatural. And all of my books have at least one sort of ghostly figure who may or may not be there. In my new book, I've got the ghost of Jesse James. And in Jim the Boy, I have, you know, a story about a haint, which is a panther who screams like a woman and speaks. I guess I also like to scare myself when I write. The scene about the haint, Jim the Boy, I wrote it in my office at Vanderbilt after everyone else had got home, and I scared myself so badly I got up and locked my door because I was afraid to be in my office by myself with my door open.
The mountain in The Blue Star seems to be sort of central to the reproduction of everybody in the story, especially when you write about the Brush Arbor revivals.
Part of the, you know, the listening that you talked about, I guess the most of it I've done is listening to my family. And they're all storytellers. And what they love to tell stories about are the way things used to be. You know, they just don't tell me stories about what's going on now. But the stories they tell about the way things used to be are really wonderful. Not only was my grandmother, this wasn't so much her experience as she was telling about the experience of her grandparents before their church was built. And they would actually hold services under a brush arbor. And so church was mostly, you know, a summertime experience and the fair weather experience. But I've heard stories my whole life about the brush arbor revivals where just, you know, out in the middle of the field, they would build, you know, a rough roof covered in branches, and people would gather under that for several days and just listen to hours and hours of preaching. And I think it was so hard for people during that time, when those particular awful roads, to get to church. You know, it was a real undertaking that they sort of tried to fill up for the year.
But to use that event as an observation of that, that was the time when it was okay for young men and women to take dark paths off by themselves.
That's the odd thing about revival, is that as a deeply spiritual time as it is, people often wind up out in the bushes in the dark kissing. I have no idea what's going on with that, but I've done a little revival kissing myself.
I sure do appreciate your taking the time to speak with me about your writing, and we look forward to hearing you.
Well, thank you for having me.